following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
What I want to do today is a really important class. I find of all the classes I do, this is one of the ones that people are most interested in, for those of us who are probably all of us who come from Christian countries. The historical roots of Christianity and Judaism, the relationship, very, very important to understand, because it speaks oceans about the historic relationship between Jews and Christians and how we view ourselves and how we view them and how they view us and they view themselves. First of all, again, to understand Christianity, we have to understand its roots in Judaism and its roots in the history of the period of time where it emerges. Okay, now this is not a class on Christian theology. It's more the historical perspective on how things evolve. So just a couple of things. One is, in terms of the historical period, we talked about previously that the notion of messianic expectation, the whole word Messiah is a Jewish word. Right? Everyone appreciates that. It comes from the Hebrew word moshach, which means to anoint. Right? If you look in the book of Samuel, where Samuel goes to anoint David to pick him as the next successor, it says he is moshach, he pours oil on his head. Okay, it means anointed, which was used for vessels and people. Now, God's anointed one, from the Jewish perspective, it's a fundamental idea in Judaism, the belief in the Messiah. The notion of who's the Messiah, again, just to review, I've said this before, it's a human being from the tribe of Judah, which is where nobility comes from, descendant of the family of King David, who will have the Torah knowledge and the leadership ability to bring all the Jewish people back to the land of Israel, rebuild the temple, and elevate not just the Jewish people, but the entire world to the realization of one God, and bring us back, as we say, to the garden. Elevate humanity back to the ideal state we're supposed to be in. So we have to understand, number one, Jewish idea, fundamental Jewish idea. By the way, the Son of God stuff, Trinity, that's antithetical, anathema to Judaism. That is not an idea which is Jewish at all. But you have to understand the idea originates in Judaism. Messianic expectation. From the historical perspective, we understand this, we'll understand why Christianity appears when it does. Since we have the notion of a person who redeemed the Jewish people as a fundamental philosophical part of the Jewish worldview, expectation of that redemption, that final redemption, will always appear at periods of time when things are bad. Okay, in periods of crises. Why? Because it's the idea that it's always darkest before the dawn. If you read in, you know, the Jewish sources, not we're talking about the book of Revelations, you know, in the Christian Bible, but even the Jewish sources like Ezekiel, we're talking about, you know, this kind of final showdown, the big battle between good and evil stuff, you know, and which doesn't mean Satan and God. That is also not a Jewish idea. Very important. The idea of Satan, of the accusing angel, is a Jewish idea. Okay, but what's the accusing angel? And Judaism is only one power, God. No one challenges God, okay? He's all-powerful. The universe is within him. This dualistic idea of good and evil, you know, an anti-God who fights against God is a Christian, again, perversion of a Jewish idea. Satan, Jewish idea, is an accusing angel, sort of a prosecuting eternity who, again, it's very metaphorical, who calls God's attention, so to speak, whatever that means, to things we're doing wrong. Okay, but there's no other powers. Okay, you have to understand that also. But the notion, even the Jewish sources talk about clearly like a sort of final showdown where Jews got their back to the wall and the Messiah appears and like the cavalry coming over the hill, we're saved. By the way, it doesn't have to be that way also. Very important point to realize when we're talking about differences between Jewish and Christian views of redemption. All good prophecies in Judaism, we say, are promises that will definitely come true. Okay, bad prophecies are warnings. Meaning, get your act together or else. Meaning, you can avoid the bad, and the good will definitely come true. When will the good happen? Well, in the Jewish perspective, again, as I said previously, our deadline is 6,000 years. Okay, by the year 6,000. We're in 5,760 now. We have 240 years left maximum. The deadline is 6,000 years. It has to be by then. But the idea is it's within our power to make it happen now. Okay, it's up to us. It will definitely happen. We don't want to wait till the end, as I said in the very first class. We don't want to wait till have to have, you know, the cavalry rescue us, the medevac helicopter, take what's left of us up to Mount, you know, we have to be. But it will definitely happen. Okay, so it's not like the final showdown, Gog and Magog, Armageddon idea, which is in Revelations, is not a Jewish idea. Final showdown could be. Could be. It'll be a final thing. The whole world comes against the Jews. But anyway, I don't want to get a whole class on the millennium either, but yeah. Okay, so we understand, therefore, that messianic redemption, a part of Judaism, expectation of messianic redemption, But what's important to understand from the historical perspective is, since we have this notion of a final confrontation and it being darkest before the dawn, and all kinds of, the actual expression used is mechev le'a Mashiach, like the birth pangs of the Messiah. You know, the idea that before, if, you know, please God, you guys all get married, you'll see your wives giving birth. That contractions when they come, if the Messiah's arrival is supposed to be something like birth pangs, that the closer you get to the event, the more painful the contractions are. Okay, it's intense. So in history, when things heat up and there's pressure and problems for the Jews, and we're getting back to the wall, we're going to expect to see that the Jewish world is going to have a lot of messianic expectation. We'll see it at the time of the Roman occupation of Israel. We'll see it in the 17th century in Shabtai Tzvi. Okay, it's many, many periods of time. There have been many times when people think the Messiah is coming. Now, we mentioned, we're talking about the different, you know, groups, the sects within Judaism during this period of time. We saw that there was these splinter groups of religious sort of fanatic extremists, not the nationalist guys. We're talking about the Essenes, the Dead Sea sect. People who split themselves off from the larger community, feeling that community was corrupted, and went into the wilderness to pray and prepare for the end and whatever, and there's going to be a final showdown, the battle, as in the Dead Sea sect documents say, the war of the sons of light against the sons of darkness. We know in the Second Temple period there were lots of people running around with this ideology, like the end is near, placards on their bodies, repent ye sinner kind of things. Get ready, it's coming. Okay? Certainly, Judeo-Christians will come out of this period of time and out of this, the situation in the Jewish world at the time. Jesus is far from the only person to be a false Messiah in Jewish history. We're talking about from the Jewish perspective here. And by the way, from the Jewish perspective, he's not even close to being the most effective. A person like Shabtai Tzvi in the 17th century is going to have a far larger percent of the Jewish world believing that he's the one than J.C. going back to whenever he supposedly lived. But we have to understand that the whole early Judeo-Christian sect, and I have to appreciate that Christianity, when it emerges, is a offshoot of Judaism. Okay? It's like the Dead Sea sect, whatever. It later emerges into a major world religion dominated overwhelmingly by non-Jews. But initially, it can be viewed as one of these offshoot religions. Okay? Appearing at a time when things are bad, high messianic expectation, etc. Okay, lots of this going on. Okay, so we have to appreciate the connotations of this. Now, as to the historicity of the main character in Christian history, which is obviously J.C. himself, we don't know. It's one of the great mysteries, you know. Did he live? Didn't he live? We're not going to get into that. Okay, when did he live? Even Christian, by the way, historians who obviously hold that he existed, say that he lived. The millennium's not the millennium. Everyone agrees that the actual year one is about 4 years before or the year one we use, and therefore the millennium was, and whatever, forgetting the whole millennium thing anyway. But there are a number of references in the Talmud, most of them, not just Talmud, some of them in commentaries in the Talmud, Rashi, that most of them, by the way, were forcibly edited out of the Talmud by Christian censors in medieval Europe. You can get a book called Chesronot HaShas. It costs like 5 shekels. It's really poorly printed. You can buy it in Raya bookstore. It's a little thing with all the little parts edited out. In Sanhedrin, there's a big one. A big, huge section of Yeshu HaNotzri, as he's called. Yeshu the Nazarene, and who his followers were and what happened to them. From the secular sources, we have little or no references to Jesus. Okay? Who would be the classic place we'd expect to find references in? Who's the great historian of this period of time? Josephus. Now, there is brief reference to Jesus in Josephus. The problem is, however, that virtually all scholars of Josephus agree it was later added in by monks or whatever who were working on the text. Why? Because it's a big problem for the greatest historian of his time not mentioning a guy who supposedly was recognized as the Messiah, and when he died, the dead walked the earth, and he was resurrected, and etc. So there's like, so in the middle of Josephus, suddenly is plopped in this mention of Jesus, and you know, okay, not even important. The Jewish sources, by the way, it's not one person. There's many different people. There's a guy named Yeshu HaNotzri. There's a guy whose mother was named Mary Magdalena, and she was a hairdresser and whatever. There's all kinds of different references. I personally view the character of Jesus as a composite character. Okay? There are many different meaning. He could have been. And by the way, the Jewish sources put this guy much earlier than the Christian sources. Like at the time of Yeshua ben Prachya. Okay, he was one of the Zugot, the head of the Sanhedrin, during the time of the Hasmoneans, about 150 years before the Common Era. Like right after the Maccabee story, the Maccabean Revolt. Okay, so we're dealing with a big black hole. Okay, we don't know. Historicity. from the Jewish sources, it's very important to understand that this character, or this composite character, or whatever he's referring to, is always viewed in the negative. I'm not going to go through all the different mentions of him, but the basic view is he's an apostate. He's a guy who goes off. He was a student of a rabbi. He gets bad ideas into his head. He goes off. He uses the powers of Tuma, spiritual forces. He does even miraculous things. Okay, it's not a class on Jewish sources on what might be the character of Yeshu HaNotzri. Is he, isn't he? Is he the Jesus character? We don't know. The Christian censors certainly thought it was, and they edited it out. Okay, but so from the Jewish perspective on such a guy is that he definitely went off the derech, as we say in Yeshivish. He went the wrong way, and we don't want any part of him, etc. The Christian perspective on Jesus is obviously very different. He's sort of a rebel preacher, born over here in Bethlehem and living up in the Galilee, more or less, and preaching. The Galilee, of course, we remember, is a hotbed of religious nationalism and radicalism, and the Romans feeling threatened by him, and the Pharisees are also being threatened by him. He gets turned into the Romans and put to death. Okay, that's their view. Again, it's not based on direct eyewitness accounts. All of the stories we have of Jesus are based on where? In the New Testament, which is in the Gospel. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. All of those guys, that we got to define our terms, by the way. There's disciples and there's apostles. Okay? Disciples are Jesus' 12 students. Okay, like Peter, you know, those guys, the fishermen up there in the Galilee. Okay, apostles like Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, those are the guys who spread the word after he's gone. Different people. Okay, the apostles aren't the disciples. They didn't meet him. They're not writing at the time. It's not like Josephus writing about the Jewish war. So the historical Jesus, so to speak, remains a big mystery. There's lots and lots of books written about it. If you're really interested, you know, there's a book called Jesus, A Life. You know, this is the new thing. Every biography is named Someone, A Life. You know, mine is going to be Get A Life. You know? But the point is, it's not really, it's important to understand from the Jewish perspective that it's a negative, whoever this guy is pretty negative. From the Christian perspective, obviously, probably most Jews are far more aware of the New Testament version of who Jesus was than they are of the traditional Jewish sources, which you, by the way, won't find in almost any Talmud. They haven't been added in because the Vilna Shas, which most of the Talmuds we have today are, had that edited out of. Okay, if you get like Steinsaltz, he has it in there, his Gemaras. But it's not in there. But okay, it's not. Yeah.
What about the Art Scroll version?
Art Scroll version, I'm not sure. I'm not sure it might be in there. I haven't looked. It might be in there. Sorry? Because it was viewed as negative things said about Christ, which is true. If it is the guy, even though it's different people and different stories way before the period of time, they're negative. The Jewish perception of guys who get weird ideas in their head, again, there's all kinds of false messiahs. Maimonides is very clear. He gives the law. He says, if a guy comes along, and miracles, remember we talked about miracles way back. Miracles don't prove anything in Judaism. We don't believe in Moses because he did cool things like splitting seas. We believe in Moses because we stood at Mount Sinai and the whole Jewish people collectively experienced prophecy. And God says, you know, Moses is the man. Okay, that's why we believe. Okay, Maimonides is very clear. If a guy comes along, and even if he's a huge Talmud Chacham, you test him. Okay, and he knows his Torah backwards, forwards, inside out. And he does a couple of miracles to prove, you know, he's cool. He's got the connection with the higher power. And then he says, change one letter of Torah, you take him out and you kill him. He's a false prophet. Doing miracles, even, there's no problem from the Jewish perspective. Guys want to walk on water, anything they want, no problem. Okay? So that miracles don't make you a prophet. It's a very important thing to understand, okay? There's been lots of false prophets in Jewish history. Jesus, if he even existed, let's give the Christians the benefit of the doubt. We'll say their basic account is correct, okay? He's a false messiah. Jewish law, put him to death. That's what Jewish law says. Not pulling any punches here. I'm being very straightforward here. And he is, by his own admission, by the admission of the New Testament and the Gospel, he's not a very effective false messiah. He has all 12 people following him, none of whom know anything. No, it's one thing if you tell me that you have, you know, Rav Shach and, you know, and all these big rabbeim saying he's the one. Rabbi Akiva says I'm the one. That's one thing. Some fishermen up in the Galilee. Okay, I'm not too impressed from the Jewish sources. So again, a guy like a Shabtai Tzvi seems to have had a lot bigger following. Okay, so we have to understand that this is the historical context, and probably now early Judeo-Christians. While we don't have a lot of references to Jesus, historical references directly when he's alive, we do have numerous references to Judeo-Christians. Who are Judeo-Christians? We'll call it the Jesus cult or the Jesus sect. Again, this is one of the sects running on the Dead Sea sect. You have the, you know, the Essenes. You had the Jesus cult. What was the Jesus cult? Early Judeo-Christians were clearly religious Jews who believed that Jesus is the Messiah. Son of God stuff comes much, much later. No Judeo-Christian would have recognized the notion of God having parts. Okay, that's an idea that's so antithetical to Judaism. Now, many people say, oh, how could that be? How could you have religious Jews walking around thinking the Messiah had come? We have an absolute perfect parallel in the modern Jewish world. So perfect that I think that's the main reason why that was created, just so I could teach it in the history class. What's the perfect parallel?
Lubavitch.
Right. Chabad Lubavitch Hasidim, not saying all of them, but anyone, forget who believes that a Chabad Hasid who believes the Rebbe was the Messiah, and now that we know he died, like what, 4 years ago now, and he's not dead, he's coming back. That is the exact ideology of early Judeo-Christians. And I say it on tape. I have no qualms. I say it to Chabad people all the time. First of all, it's kfira. You're denying a basic tenet of Judaism. Could a guy like that, could the Rebbe have been Messiah? Maybe. Okay, possibly. He's a great man, for sure. But once you're dead, too bad. You lost it. You blew the opportunity. Okay? The Messiah doesn't. Why did the Christian world invent the notion of second coming? Because they borrowed the Jewish definition of what Messiah is. Okay, changed it a little. He's supposed to do certain things. Redeem the world, whatever, you know. Did Jesus do it in his lifetime? No, he was crucified by the Romans and nothing changed. So what's he going to do? He'll come back later and do it. It took the Christian world a while to come up with that idea. It took Chabad a very short period of time, at least those people within the Lubavitch movement, to come up with this idea that he's not dead, he's coming back. By the way, this extreme in Lubavitch now, we even call for the recognition of the divine essence of the Rebbe. Which is completely, that's like way off the, now he's becoming like the Trinity thing here. I'm not saying all Chabad people have lost their minds, that's not the point. But you cannot believe in Judaism that a person is the Messiah and the Messiah is dead. And he's coming back, whatever. I'm not saying this to knock Chabad at all. I'm saying this to show you the early context of what the Judeo-Christians were. They were people who kept glatt kosher. Could walk around with the black hats and everything, black hats back then. But they could look as firm as you and I, keep the most kosher standards, keep Shabbat. They just believed in this is the guy. He did it. Same exact parallel. Now, at the time, there's no question in my mind, and almost all historians say the same thing. As we like to say, roses are red, it's violets are bluish. If it wasn't for Paul, we'd all be Jewish. Which is not really true either. I don't believe that either. But there's no question in my mind, if not for a man by the name of Paul of Tarsus, Saul, Judeo-Christians would have been a minor splinter group that would have died out 2,000 years ago, and that would have been it, and all human history would have been different. Okay, why? Because it just wasn't taken off. We know already that the rabbis, going back 2,000 years, were already going after these guys. As a matter of fact, there are 18 blessings. You know, there are 18 blessings of the Shemona Esrei. There are really 19. You know, it's like the 48 ways, but there are 50 tapes, that kind of thing. We add a blessing in, which is called Lamalshinim. It's a blessing against the Minim. Who are Minim? Minim, according to all Jewish scholars that I've read, are Judeo-Christians. Notzrim is the term for pagan Christians. Meaning, the rabbis realized that these Judeo-Christians were off in their ideology, even though they went to temple, they went to synagogue with everyone else, and they prayed, and they kept kosher, and they hung out at the butcher, and the pickle store, and the bagel guy. But you got to watch out for these guys because they have an ideology that is off and it's going to pollute the Jewish people. We got to drive them out of the community. So I want to read you from, this is from Brachot 28b. This is talking about adding in the 19th blessing. It says, these 18 benedictions are really 19. Rabbi Levi said, the blessings against the heretics, Minim, was innovated at Yavna. Meaning, who's Yavna again? Remember we talked about it yesterday? Who goes there? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Goes, he gets the Sanhedrin moved there, and Rebbe Gamliel, he then abdicates his position not too long after, and gives it over to Rebbe Gamliel, a descendant of Hillel, from the Davidic line, to be the Nasi of the Sanhedrin. And I want to keep reading here. Our rabbis taught, Shimon HaPikulei arranged the 18 benedictions in order before Rebbe Gamliel at Yavna. The final closing of the blessings, which we say was started by the men of the Great Assembly before, but the final like sealing of what the Shemona Esrei is, was put together by the men at Yavna. Standard form, final form of standardized prayer. Rabban Gamliel said to the sages, is there nobody who knows how to innovate a blessing against the heretics? The word used here in Hebrew is minim. Shmuel HaKatan arose and innovated it. Okay, he made up this blessing, Lamal Shinim, that for these they should be thrown out of the community. The following year, he forgot it, and he concentrated for 2 or 3 hours to remember it, but they did not remove him from the leading the prayers. Meaning he himself gets up to pray. It was a test used by the rabbis to weed out Judeo-Christians. Because they wouldn't say this blessing. It's like the secret handshake, you know? So the guy who invents the blessing forgets to say it. Maybe he's really secretly a min. He's a Judeo-Christian. He wasn't. He just like had a little lapse of thought there. But the point is, we can already see that the rabbis of the period of time, so this is a splinter sect within Judaism. There's no place in Judaism. It is against Judaism. Got to get rid of it. Okay? And there's no question that clearly Judeo-Christians would have died out along with the Essenes and the Dead Sea sect and everyone else and the Sadducees, and everything would be different today. Someone had a question?
The prayer that says, thank God for not making me a god.
Yeah. What about it?
Is that what you're talking about?
No. Not the Lo Shelo Asani Goy. We're talking about if you look at the Amida, the 19 blessings, the 18 blessings, which are really 19, there was one added later, La Malshinim. Okay, open up a prayer book later. You'll see it's in there. It's in the Shemona. It's in the middle of the Shemona Esrei. You'll see it in there. It's again. But heretics are not people who are like, you know, heretics are not people who are siding with the wrong football team here. We're talking about Judeo-Christians. All the scholars say that. Okay. So what do we have? Let's see where we are. We're talking about a splinter group that appears at a period of time of high messianic expectation, basically religious Jews with an idea that's slightly off, that as the rabbis realize is dangerous, and they try and separate it from the Jewish community. Okay. Along comes, and the leaders in the struggle are, again, the Pharisees, the Perushim. All of these guys are the heads of the Sanhedrin, the great rabbis. And they're embarking on this campaign at a period of time, we realize, when Judaism is in tremendous transition. It's a very difficult period of time. We've lost the temple. We've suffered tremendous physical hardship at the hands of the Romans. And they're really trying to keep the Jewish people together and keep things from fraying at the edges. Now, again, probably all of this would have been at the end of the story, except for a man by the name of Paul of Tarsus, who lives on the latter half of the first century of the Common Era. Paul's original name is Saul. He's from Asia Minor, okay, over in Mesopotamia area. He, according to his own description of himself, starts out as one of the Pharisees, a Pharisaic Jew, as I like to call him, anti-Judeo-Christian. Okay, he's one of the guys who persecuted them. And he has this vision on his way to Tarsus, or from Tarsus, I remember where it's to, from, where basically Jesus appears to him and says, why are you persecuting my followers? And he has this miraculous transformation where he goes from being anti-Christian to being pro-Judeo-Christian. And Paul is going to embark on what is clearly the greatest PR innovation in religious history. Because until that time, if you wanted to become a Judeo-Christian, you had to become Jewish. You had to be circumcised and go through a conversion process because you had to keep the commandments, because that's what Judeo-Christianity was all about. Okay? Paul comes along, and if you look in the books of Acts, this is a huge topic of discussion. And he introduces a major innovation, which is the idea that Christianity can be opened up to Gentiles. Why? Because belief in Jesus is a substitution for belief in the commandments. Okay? And that is going to be the major change. It's going to make Christianity from a sect of Judaism to a major world religion with huge, huge appeal. Let's stop there for a minute and let's go back and see, why is this going to be appealing to the Gentiles? We talked a lot about the negative interaction of Jews and Gentiles in the Greco-Roman world, the Hellenistic Jewish confrontation. But we have to also appreciate that there's a lot of positive interaction between Jews and Hellenists and citizens. First of all, you can't live amongst the people without having positive interaction. It's not all negative. But spiritually speaking, we know that Judaism was a very attractive thing in the Greco-Roman world. Remember we talked about Rome was a international empire that had a state religion. There's a very close connection between church and state, religion and state in human history. Very close. Roman state religion was an affirmation of the power of the Roman Empire. Okay, emperors were deified after they were dead, and sometimes they even deified when they were alive. Okay, it was all part and parcel of saying that the gods are with the government. And not only that, you're looking like in ancient Egypt where Pharaoh is a living god. And not only that, that the government has complete control over your physical well-being and your spiritual well-being. So therefore, state religion, observance of state religious function, was equivalent to showing your loyalty to the state, which is why it's so amazing that Jews, despite all the negative interaction with Romans, were granted exemptions from state Roman religious functions, because then the Romans knew the Jews would never do it because it was pagan. And remember I said in place of that, the Jews were allowed to offer sacrifices in the temple to show their allegiance to Rome. Okay, but Rome had a very ancient state religion, which, by the way, as it expands, is going to absorb all the other gods into its religion. Meaning there are literally there's all kinds of cults and religions. First of all, the Greek and Roman gods merge. Jupiter and Zeus, Mars and Aries, they become the same thing. Okay, so we have a big amalgamation because polytheistic religions are very multicultural and very open. I worship your God, you worship mine, I conquer your people, I absorb your gods into my culture. The Roman historian Varro says that by the first century of the Common Era, okay, which in Rome is becoming already on the way to becoming a big empire, the Romans had in excess of 30,000 gods. 30,000 gods. That's an amazing piece of information. Even if he's exaggerating. Why? Because every culture that they came in contact with had sometimes hundreds, if not thousands, of gods. The Egyptians had 2,000 gods. We conquer Egypt, we absorb the 2,000 Egyptian gods. And therefore you could pick and choose and da-da-da. Okay? So you have an overwhelming number of choices of what to worship and what gods. But one thing we see, it's also very interesting, is that during the height of Roman power, you know, first century of a common era, when Rome is really on the up and up, that Romans didn't seem to be too satisfied with the old religions. Okay, there's just too much. I mean, there's this kind of old hat for them. Roman gods are not particularly inspiring, by the way. We read Greek mythology. It's very bawdy. You know, like you look at paganism. It's very, you know, the gods act like worse than people. There's all these machinations. They're killing this guy and that, and they're sleeping around and doing it. It's not a really, it's kind of like an old, stale, unsatisfying religion. We know for a fact that Romans, in the first couple centuries of the Common Era, were looking spiritually for something new and different, something that would satisfy them. And this is a very similar case to what? Where's the parallel today? You see in the West, right? You know, the old religions, they're stale. Even, you see the Jews and Christians who are not particularly into Judaism and Christianity. Where do they look? They look to the East, okay? Because the East is exotic, it's very different. It's generally more abstract, more profound. Same thing in the Roman Empire. Now, the East in the Roman Empire was not China. China was a place that was basically unknown to the Romans. Okay, the Far East, India. It was like they knew it was there, but it wasn't something that there was any interaction with. The East in the Roman Empire was the Eastern Roman Empire, which is Persia, Israel, Egypt, that part of the world. So we have a lot of Romans who are spiritually searching. They want something different and better, new, something that would satisfy them. And by the way, the other thing was that they saw that, look, Rome, for all of its, you know, government and law, was becoming very, very decadent. The moral fiber, it's this great parallels between this and what's going on in the world today. The moral fiber of the society is, you know, like look at America, it's terrible. The statistics, I just read an article about, you know, the majority of children are now born in families with one-parent families in America or divorce. It's incredible. Everything's fraying. Violence, crime, sexual immorality. You know, the Rome really got into this. They became very decadent. People were looking for stability. They were looking for a more universal vision, okay, a moral view of the world. They didn't find it in the old pagan religions of the empires of the West, so they looked east. The two most exotic Eastern religions in the Roman Empire were not Buddhism and Hinduism. They were Judaism and Zoroastrianism. Okay, Judaism, we know what that is. Zoroastrianism is the religion of the Persian Empire, which is it is a very unusual, it's in between monotheism and paganism. It's a dualistic religion of light and darkness. The Talmud always talks about not lending lanterns. I'm talking about Babylon. Don't lend lanterns to the Gentiles during their holidays regarding light, because they use lanterns because it's light and darkness. It's one of their idolatrous things, and you're going to help them to work, practice their idolatrous things. Specifically amongst Zoroastrianism, there's a sub-cult called the Mithra cult, the bull worship cult, which you found all over the Roman Empire, very popular amongst the Roman army, Roman legionnaires. This little cave with a certain time of the year when the sun would shine through. I don't get to the mythology of Mithraism. But these were the exotic religions, okay? And a lot of Romans were drawn to them. Just like today, people were into transcendental meditation and Buddhism and everything else. What was the specific appeal of Judaism in the Roman world? What do you think? What was so attractive about Judaism? Again, it's not the kosher food. You know, gefilte fish was not around then. Yeah. Right, one God was a big thing. The essence of Judaism, which makes it so different, is one invisible God. In a world where you have 30,000 visible gods and little Getchkal idols everywhere and temples, and you know, it's very clear and clean. Okay, it's very abstract and strange to many, but it's very clear and clean. But it's the implications of the one God. Look what Judaism is saying, that there's one God, all-powerful, a loving God who wants a relationship with all his creation. It's a universal vision. Not just of all of humanity together under one God, but a universal vision of morality. In a morally relative world where this guy says this is okay and another guy says no, that's wrong, Judaism is very clear-cut. It's also a religion that comes with, it's a very legalistic religion. The Romans love law. Very law and order religion, Judaism. You can do this, you can't do that. Very clear in its vision and in its application. Okay? And very exotic, very mystical. You know, you have a whole spiritual tradition which is so different from anything else. In a world with such instability morally and ethically and so many choices, so overwhelming, Judaism is very, very clear. And not only that, we see that it created a practical society that was very different from the very cold, calculating, cruel Roman world. Any Roman who interacted with Jewish community saw that Jews have social welfare. Jews take care of their own. People don't starve to death in Jewish communities. Jews give charity. Okay, and Jews also even help non-Jews. It's amazing. And not only that, look at these Jews. They're the most literate people in the world. They're intellectual. They're spiritual. It's great. It's a really nice thing. These people have a really great religion. Yeah?
So you're saying that a lot of Romans converted into Judaism?
No, I'm not saying that. Hold on. Hold on to that question. I'm not saying a lot of Romans converted to Judaism. We do know. Now, okay, so are we clear what we're holding so far? Now, I want to now explode one of the great myths that you hear in yeshiva. Okay, ready? Jewish people never proselytized. Wrong. Proselytize is to openly seek conversions. During the first couple of centuries before and after the Common Era, we have a tremendous amount of Jewish proselytization going on, meaning Jews actively seeking Gentile converts. Now, by the way, I want to distinguish clearly. Nowhere in Torah does it say you should proselytize. You're not supposed to. Nor did the rabbis ever condone it. But there were certainly numerous personalities in the Jewish world who were actively involved in trying to bring the pagan world to monotheism. Most famous of all, anyone know? Philo Judaeus, who lived 2,000 years ago in Alexandria. He's one of the most prolific writers in the ancient world. Philo means lover. Judaeus, Jew. Okay? Philo is not like some assimilated Jewish guy writing propaganda. Philo, I would say, is probably closer to like a modern Orthodox Jew of the ancient world. He was into Hellenistic culture, the modern world, but he was extremely proud of being Jewish, and he lived in the most cultured city in the world, Alexandria in Egypt. Philo is constantly, and he had a huge, huge, huge following amongst the non-Jewish world. And Jews don't read Philo. Non-Jews absolutely went berserk over this guy. They devoured everything he wrote. His whole message was, look, guys, get with the program. We Jews have the vision for humanity. The whole world should unite and keep Torah, and the world will be a better place. We have clear records in Roman law of Jews being expelled from Rome for proselytizing. While Romans would tolerate Jews, certainly Romans would definitely tolerate Jews practicing their religion, they did not tolerate Jews trying to get Gentiles to become Jewish. Okay? And Jews were expelled from Rome because of that. At least two. I know during the reign of Tiberius it happened. It happened at a previous period of time to that. So there's a lot of interest in Judaism. There were more than enough Jews actively going around, pushing the Greco-Roman world to be interested in Judaism. And what's the consequence? We know for a fact that there were thousands upon thousands upon thousands of Gentiles who were keeping to some level Torah. Okay, the New Testament, which mentions these people, very interesting, calls them the God-fearers. Okay, when I say keeping Torah, they didn't go through a formal conversion process and become Jewish. But so bad was the situation that Seneca, the Roman historian, writes, and I quote, "The customs of this accursed people have become so prevalent, the vanquished have given their laws to the victors." This is after the Great Revolt, Seneca. He says Judaism has become such a popular religion that all, you look out, you know, Friday night, you look out on the city of Rome and half the houses, and no one's, you know, making a barbecue outside. Because there's thousands of Roman pagans keeping Shabbos and eating kosher. Like the butcher suddenly can't keep up with the demand. All the Gentiles want, you know, kosher hot dogs. Remember the Hebrew National commercial, we have to answer to a higher authority? It wasn't just because it was health food. It's healthier, you know, Jewish kosher meat. Yeah. It's because they wanted to connect to God by keeping Torah. It's very interesting. Okay, very interesting. So we know for a fact this is the reality. A huge interest, a huge positive interest in Judaism. We have all kinds of cases of people converting. According to Jewish tradition, who's the most famous convert just about in Jewish history from this period of time? He wrote a very famous translation of the Bible into Aramaic.
Uncleus
Hager, who according to tradition is Nero's nephew. According to historians say, Pompeia, Nero's wife, converted to Judaism. There are even Jewish sources who say that Nero himself could have converted. Okay, you can't prove that. Anyone in the street, Heleni Hamalka Street in Jerusalem?
Yes.
There's a place called, there was a kingdom of Abedin, I'm not pronouncing exactly right, where the king and his queen convert to Judaism. And a lot of the whole kingdom, a lot of them follow along with it. Heleni Hamalka is named after her. She goes and brings gifts to the temple and everything. Okay, what's that? I'm not pronouncing it right. It's something Aberdeen. I can never pronounce it correctly. But we see that it obviously, and the appeal was not with the lower classes. The appeal was specifically with better educated, upper class people who are more attracted. Just as today we see people who are into alternative religions overwhelmingly come from better educated people. Okay, because they're more worldly, they're more exposed, they have more time to be searchers. Yeah?
And the question is, wasn't this more
dilettantism
than real, heartfelt?
No, all the indications are that what this, and the indications are clearly from history proves it not to be a fad. It was not something that was cool to do. It was a genuine interest. And we go to the last part of the class now, I'll show you how genuine it was. It's very clear the interest is overwhelmingly positive and legitimate and not something just that's superficial. Yeah? There were definitely, I said, we do have instances of Gerim a lot. Now, here's the last part of the riddle to throw in.
What time was this? What year was this?
We're talking about, well, again, this is not 1 year. This is the first couple of centuries of the Common Era. And it's going to decline according to the Roman perception of the Jew. As that gets worse, there's going to be less interest in Judaism because the image of the Jew is going to be that much worse. Now, I said that little rhyme before, roses are reddish, violets are bluish. If it wasn't for Paul, we'd all be Jewish, meaning the whole Roman world would become Jewish. Personally, I don't think that would ever have happened. Okay, and all the historians I've read, and by the way, you want a great book, I highly recommend, excellent book on the history of Christianity, Paul Johnson, A History of Christianity, best single volume book. And boy, does he rip Christianity apart. But he's very good. No, he's an English Christian historian. He wrote a good book on Judaism called The History of the Jews. I highly, 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 highly recommend that book. If you want to read one book on the history of the church, read that book.
He's not biased at all.
No, he's definitely no. Everyone is biased. Like they say, not even God can change history. Only historians can. Everyone is biased. Okay, no, but he's very. But there's a lot. But he's Paul Johnson, A History of Christianity. Get it from Amazon. Get it from wherever you can buy it. It's a great book to read. But he goes the first chapter. He goes through this very nicely. Explains it. I mean, not his original idea. I've seen numerous historians say the same thing. I do not believe for a minute that if not for Paul, the whole world would become Jewish. Why? On the plus side, people like Judaism because of all the things I said previously. What do you think the negative side of Judaism was in the eyes of the Gentiles of the Greco-Roman world? Sorry?
The strict ways.
Right. First of all, it was a highly limiting legalistic religion. It's one thing to keep kosher and Shabbos, and that's cool and fun and spiritually uplifting. Like today, everyone wants Kabbalah without having to keep commandments. I want the mysticism without the practical application of Jewish law. What do you think the least popular commandments were in the Bible in the Greco-Roman world?
No.
The least popular, who?
Idolatry.
No, circumcision. Circumcision, which is fundamental to Judaism, which the Greco-Roman world considered mutilation of the body. And by the way, it's one thing to do it when you're 8 days old. Try doing it when you're 35 with no local anesthetic. That was considered, and going to the mikveh was also very unpopular. So there were certain things, and not only that, so there were certain commandments which were completely ran against their worldview, but not only that, more important than anything else, Judaism was viewed as, because it's not a religion, it is Judaism and Jewish people are one and the same. It's the national worldview of the Jewish people. When you convert to Judaism, you're becoming a Jew. It's not like being a Christian, like I have a national identity plus a religious component to my identity. I could be an American, I could be a Muslim, I could be a Jew, I can be, we're saying, Judaism, you're becoming one of the Jewish people. And we're going to see, as we already saw in history, after the destruction of the Second Temple, the Great Revolt, quietus is war, 114 to 117, right? And Bar Kokhba. By the middle of the second century, the Jews, having rebelled more than anyone else against the Romans, had this title of Dedetici, right? People who are hostile to Roman law. You join the Jewish people, you're joining an enemy of Rome. Okay, and that's like a heavy thing. So people are really interested. They love the ethical view. They love the mystical stuff. They love some of the commandments as elevating and spiritually uplifting and the whole social infrastructure and all that. But they wouldn't take the leap. So they're called God-fearers. Now, who knows? If not for Christianity, maybe we would have had a massive conversion to B'nai Noach. I don't know. They would have all kept the seven Noahide laws. We can't speculate on what would have been. Paul of Tarsus comes along in the first century. And again, it's one of the most interesting topics. And he comes along and says, you don't have to keep the commandments. Until that time, right, to be a Judeo-Christian, you had to convert. He says there are Christians of the covenant who are Judeo-Christians and Christians from the Gentile world. Belief in Jesus replaces keeping of the commandments. Now you can get the whole beautiful vision. The one God. Okay, later he has parts, but that's not an idea at the time. You get the one God thing, the God of all humanity, a loving God. You get the whole moral, ethical vision, all the beautiful moral ideas, of course, the Christians keep. You know, love your neighbor and all that stuff. But you don't have to do anything different. Just believe in Jesus and you're saved. Okay? That is great. And suddenly, then the Christian world is like, wait, I want that Jewish stuff. Now I have all the barriers removed. Let's go. Let's go for it. Now, Paul, by the way, the end of Paul is that the Jews complain about him to the Romans. The Romans hated the Christians. They're much more threatened by the Christians than by the Jews. Not that Christianity ever had an armed revolt against Rome, but Christianity as a universal religion open to all pagans threatened to undermine that which was fundamental to the stability of the empire, which was Roman state religion. Okay? So Christianity has to go underground immediately. Okay, if you go to Israel, you see these little house churches. It was practiced in secret. Okay? Both in the Jewish world and within the pagan world, because the Romans would hunt you down and feed you to lions. Okay, Paul himself ends up being arrested by the Roman authorities, goes to jail in Caesarea. As a Roman citizen, he demands to be put on trial in Rome, where he's put on trial and executed. And that's why they built over there, you know, St. Paul's and the Vatican. That's supposedly the burial site of Paul. The first leader of the church, followed by, I believe it's James, Jesus' younger brother, etc. But Christianity goes from being a small splinter sect of Jews to very rapidly an unstoppable force within the Roman world. Now, the early church fathers are Jews. They're these, okay? One thing we have to keep in mind is Christianity, unlike Judaism, Judaism has a basic corpus of information that we're given at Mount Sinai, which can be adapted, but has always been there from the beginning. The oral law, the 630 commandments, always there. Christianity is not a revealed religion. It's an evolving religion that evolves over hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. The New Testament, the gospel, okay, they start to put that in place around the year 200. It isn't finished till like 382, the final version of it. Okay? What's collected, what's in it, what's not in it. The whole notion of what Jesus is one of the most highly debated topics in early Christianity. In the 4th century, look up Paul Johnson, whatever, the Arian heresy. We have this father, son. That only, by the way, appears when Christianity becomes overwhelmingly followed by pagans, because Judeo-Christians would never have had this Trinity idea. Christianity is very much a synthesis of Jewish ideas and pagan ideas with Greek thought all coming together to evolve into a new religion, which is still evolving. You have huge splits. But initially you have to understand it starts out as a persecuted Jewish sect. Then it goes to being an underground religion of the Roman Empire, which is persecuted. During like the reigns of Roman emperors like Diocletian, he embarks on tremendous persecution of the Christians, especially in the 3rd century, where there's a lot of instability in the Roman Empire. It's a very bad time for the Christians, fed to the lions, you name it. And the Christians learn from the Jews the idea of martyrdom. Okay, we taught the world the idea of dying for your beliefs. The Christians are totally into this. All early Renaissance, you look at this Renaissance art, the murder, you know, St. Stephen martyred this guy, and they're all sitting there with arrows sticking into them and being crucified. They were totally into this idea. Okay, that's very much they got that from the Jews also. But it emerges again, persecuted religion for hundreds of years until 312, during the reign of a man by the name of Constantine, the Roman emperor. This is when the Roman Empire is already going into decline. Okay, Constantine in 312 issues an edict of toleration. Okay, by 324 we have the edict of toleration was deliberately focusing on Christians to allow Christianity to be freely practiced. He realized if you can't beat them, join them. We're fighting against something that's unstoppable. Okay? By 324, we have the Council of Nicaea, which is when the Christians get together for the first time. Constantine gets all the bishops, the leaders of the church together, and tries to get them to agree on what Christianity is all about, which is a really hotly debated topic. Jesus, he's the Son, he's like equal to, he's different, separate, da-da-da-da. It's a big, very interesting topic they finally come up with, what is called Orthodox Christianity. Okay? By 380, the Roman Emperor Theodosius makes Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire. So by the end of the 4th century, it's an amazing rise. It goes from persecuted splinter sect of the Jewish people to a religion which in the 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th centuries, and all these different apostles, people go all over the world, converting all these pagans to Christianity. So what do you have? We have an Old Testament, now we have a new version, a New Testament. Okay? This is going to be a huge revolution in the spiritual evolution of all of humanity. Huge revolution. And by the way, Maimonides, just to end with this thought, Maimonides says, you know, why did... Ideally, it's clear from the Jewish perspective that we should have done it directly. There should have been no intermediate religions, because once we have other religions that are offshoots of us but now claim to have replaced us, the Christian idea is replacement theology. You Jews were chosen, but you rejected Jesus, and God rejected you, and now he chose us. Okay? So now we have competition. This is not so good. Now we're hated for being too similar to them. We used to be hated for being too different. Now we're too similar. Maimonides says very interesting. He says, why was Christianity, Islam, invented? Before that time, it was Jews versus everyone else, and no one could contemplate the idea of one God, and it was a crazy idea, etc. Now the whole world, hundreds of millions of people walking around talking about God and morality and redemption, the world now understands and accepts what is basic Jewish worldview, albeit with some parts of it that are not acceptable to the Jews anymore, but it's a huge step from the Jewish perspective in terms of what's going on, of bringing humanity indirectly, and not only the ideal way from the Jewish perspective, but bringing humanity to the realization of this idea of one God.
This program is part of a series. For the continuation, please insert the next disc.